Sunshine with 47 degrees in Kenosha, 46 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending part one of today's program with two people who are returning to the morning show, one after not too long a time away, and the other, it's been many, many years since we've had her on the program. I'm so excited to have back Sean Britton, who is the director of the current Racine Theatre Guild production, a comedy called Drop Dead. And joining her, an important member of the cast who actually joined us just a few months ago, Ed Steckley, a very talented artist who joined us back in early summer to talk about his work as an artist in several different media. And as I mentioned, he is a key cast member in this play called Drop Dead by Billy Van Zandt and Jane Milmore. And this production opened last weekend at the Racine Theatre Guild to rave reviews. I talked to several different people who were at one of those first performances and who thought it was absolutely sensational. So I'm excited to see it myself and very excited about this conversation to learn a little bit more about this really intriguing play. Sean Britton, Ed Steckley, we welcome both of you back to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
Great to be back.
To be here. Yes.
Glad that we can have this conversation and that you can be joining us. Sean, you were telling me that you're pretty sure the last time you were on the morning show was when we were located in an entirely different building.
Yes, indeed it was. Don't ask me the date, though.
It's been a long time. So many of you have perhaps seen Sean Britton on the stage of the Racine Theatre Guild and other theaters here in the area. Very highly regarded actress, but also a very, very busy director. And back at the Racine Theatre Guild, directing Drop Dead. How many plays have you directed at the Racine Theatre Guild over the years?
There's been three. This is the fourth one at the Theatre Guild.
Very good. Where else have you directed?
Well, I've directed at Lakeside Players. I've directed for Cabbage City Theatre, which I did for like 7 years. I can't even tell you how many plays we did. And of course, I did my first directing foray was Holy Communion Church.
Very good. I remember that fondly. Well, it's great to have you back on the morning show and excited to talk with you about Drop Dead. And Ed Steckley, whom we spoke of as I talked about a few months ago about your work as an artist. That's
what?
How you pay the rent.
Oh.
But you were on stage at the Racine Theater Guild in the cast of Mamma Mia. Remind me, I honestly don't remember the answer to this. How much had you been on stage before the Theater Guild's production of Mamma Mia?
Mamma Mia was my first show, and I wanted to come back to this show to try to get it right. I did a lot of improv in New York City, but this was a lot different. And I just, when I moved into town a few months ago, I just decided to try out for a show because I have some friends at the Guild. And I figured, oh, why not? It could be fun. I like to sing. And I like to sing so much that I did this show, which is not a musical.
No, not a musical.
Not yet.
Not until Ed breaks into song.
Yeah. There you go. So, as I mentioned, this production actually opened last weekend, and I heard so many good reports about it, so I'm excited to talk again. Sean, first of all, tell us a little bit about how an assignment or a gig like this comes to you. I mean, does the phone ring and the Theater Guild say, we want you to come direct Drop Dead? Or was it more that we want you to come direct something and kind of together you figure out that this is the play you end up doing? I mean, how exactly did this opportunity come to you?
Doug Insness, director, you know, of the Theater Guild, contacted me and asked me specifically if I wanted to do Drop Dead. And of course, it's absolutely necessary to make sure that you read the play before you say yes or no. I've read Drop Dead, and I laughed really hard all by myself in my office at the house, and I said yes.
So you didn't have much in the way of acquaintance with this play before reading it?
Not at all. None whatsoever. I had never heard of it. The playwrights, of course, we've all heard of the Van Zants, and so it was intriguing, but I was sold on it once I read it. And it's funny because sometimes a play will read well, and then it's entirely different in production. But this one just keeps getting funnier because my stage manager and all the crew and myself, we all keep laughing at it, and we've seen it a lot.
Mm. So that says something when a play sort of retains its appeal and its freshness, even when you live with it and inside of it for a long, long time.
Absolutely.
So my understanding is that this play was written back in 1985, and it's probably important for people to understand that Billy Van Zandt, who co-wrote it with Jane Millmore, is somebody with considerable background in a lot of different acting, including film and television and so on. And it's that kind of wide array of experience in the world of actors and actresses that really probably led him to be able to write this play as well as he did.
Absolutely. And I think that there are so many references to so many different things that you would never catch them all in one sitting. And although it's a show within a show, and it's about actors, you know, and what they have to face when they do live theater, there are so many folks that are familiar enough sitting in the audience that they know there are times when props or costumes malfunction or aren't there, or when somebody gets caught up in something that, you know, is not what they expected. And so it's an appreciation of live theater in itself.
So explain to our listeners kind of the central premise of Drop Dead and why we have this group of actors presenting some kind of play within the play Drop Dead. Explain the scenario.
I'd like to know this myself.
Well, it's first of all, it's a bunch of actors and a director who are either perhaps past their zenith or somebody that's really new or somebody that has never done acting before. And so it's up to our director, who Ed plays in the show, to get them through their dress rehearsal. And of course, everything goes wrong in the dress rehearsal, which normally you go, oh yeah, this is a great time for things to go wrong because it's the dress rehearsal. And of course, it is a murder mystery slash comedy. So the next act is opening night. And anything that can happen will happen.
So explain the way in which this becomes, unexpectedly in some ways, a murder mystery. I mean, in what way does murder enter the picture?
Well, in the first act, we do find out that an actor that has been rehearsing with these people was brutally murdered. And nobody quite knows what the situation there is. So they hire a TV repairman to take his place. And he happens to be a cousin of Martin Scorsese. So in the first act, they're desperately trying to get through all the malfunctions that are going on. And it starts getting a little bit iffy because there are a few things that happen that make everyone uncomfortable, that perhaps they may be the next person to be murdered. And who is doing this? So therein lies the mystery.
There is the murder mystery of Drop Dead. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Sean Britton, who is the director of the Racine Theatre Guild's production of Drop Dead, and Ed Steckley, who performs the role of Victor Lepue. We're going to hear about who Victor is in just a moment. Sean, maybe it would be interesting for our listeners to kind of hear a little bit about the array of different kinds of actors who comprise the cast of this play within a play. And that's not even the entire cast, but that's, of course, most of the play.
True. Well, there is the woman who has had a top 10 rated show that beat Dharma and Greg for several years, but that was in the past, and so now she's trying to revive her career. There is an actress whom they refer to as Ancient that was familiar with Olivier and Jessica Hume and and Richard Burton, and she's deaf. And which makes it a little bit tough to be in a play when you can't hear your actor's cues. There is the Shakespearean-trained actor who thinks he's the greatest, who has practiced his craft on a mountain in the wind, reciting Shakespeare with pebbles in his mouth. There's a young actor who's playing an older part, and his makeup is completely overdone. And he's trying very hard, but he tends to have to look at his lines inside his jacket or underneath his drink tray. There's the TV repairman who has stepped in for the murdered actor. Who am I forgetting yet? Oh, there's Ed, but he's...
there's Candy.
Right.
There's Candy. Okay, our resident... And it's hard to say this. She's the cutest little bimbo you've ever seen. And she's excellent. The director of the show actually gets a little frustrated with her because you can see that she's mouthing every other actor's lines. She has the entire play memorized.
That's how she remembers her lines.
Yes. And she chews bubblegum and pops it while they're on stage, which... he also finds a little frustrating.
And there's a stage manager who does his best to hold everything together.
He does. He's just like, he is such a gopher, and he's actually, he holds Victor, the director, in very high regard, and he tries to fix everything. He only gets $35 to construct and paint a set, which turns out to be a little bit frustrating because there's a lot of stuff that's simply painted on the set, like chairs in a fireplace. And then there's the director.
And we'll meet him in just a moment. His name is Victor Lepue, and of course we have him here. Ed Steckley portrays him. Before we hear from Ed, how would you characterize this particular character?
Okay. Make it good.
Well, yeah, before I do that, there's also the producer of the show. We have the director and the producer, and the producer is quite a character. He wants to make the show something a little bit different than what it is, and he happens to have a relationship with Candy Apples, who is the little girl that... that is chews gum and mouths everyone's lines.
Mm. And they're clashing with the playwright.
Mm. Yes.
Who is the director, the playwright, and the producer, all butting heads.
Yes, and the playwright ends up on the stage during rehearsal trying to tell them that they cut his 576-page play into 18 pages, which includes the prop list.
Oh, dear. So we have, in trying to control this wild array of actors of varying ability levels, the director, Victor Lepeux, and Ed, you get to portray this character. What do you want to tell us about him?
I have a fun role because I'm the guy, I'm basically the straight man of the show, I'd say.
Yeah.
So I have to keep everything in working order and keep everything together, which I'm sure a director would agree is kind of like herding cats.
Yes.
So I'm the one who gets to be exasperated dealing with clashing egos and different theater ideologies. And I do a lot of, you know, getting frustrated while everyone else does their thing and wants to have their moment in the sun, while I just sit there and seethe, which is a lot of fun to do on stage. Seethe.
One of the things I read about this character in a review is that he is ego-driven. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, that's exactly right. He, like Sean said, he peaked a long time ago and had a couple failures and is now being reminded of those throughout the show and simply believes that he just hasn't had his moment yet and it's coming with this show. So he takes it a lot more seriously than he probably should, and it works out. Hilarity ensues.
Yes. At one point, he tells everyone that he has clippings.
Well, then,
yeah,
okay.
And as a non-director, I had to ask Sean what that meant. After a few weeks of rehearsal, I would say, I'm saying this line. Could someone explain this to me? And everyone in the cast who has done lots of theater collectively said, you're an idiot. It means he's been written up.
Right.
And I went, thank you.
So, Sean, I should think one of the real challenges of this is, particularly when it comes to the parts of the play which are the play within the play, to kind of make that clear to the audience or some kind of distinction between the offstage stuff and then the stuff which is actors acting on the stage but sort of one step removed from how it typically would be. How have you handled that in terms of kind of making that real and making that clear to the audience?
Well, fortunately, because Act One is the dress rehearsal and Act Two is opening night, that's kind of the delineation. But the problem is that by the time they get to opening night, those lines have blurred considerably. So it's the audience can see through the physicality and what is going on there that there is a difference between the rehearsal and the opening night. And I guess part of the fun is that it pours over from one to the other.
Now, Ed, is your character seen in Act Two? If Act Two is the performance itself, because, of course, typically we see a director in a rehearsal and not in a performance.
My character spends the first act right there off stage making comments as the show goes on. In Act Two, I can't do that. So a lot of the things that I hollered at people in Act One to not do happen in Act Two. So there might be an air of me in the background gritting my teeth, but there are some situations that occur where I do have to make a number of appearances in Act Two. No spoilers, but hilarity ensues.
Yes, we are trying desperately not to have any spoilers, but Victor does return.
Victor returns.
Another thing that I read about this play, this was in a review of a production someplace several years ago, was that the play is the play within the play, is not supposed to be very good, and it's supposed to be a rather low-budget kind of affair. So, for instance, at least in this particular production being reviewed, the set was constructed in such a way to make it more apparent that this is something being done on a shoestring and not, for instance, you know, the pretty polished sets that tend to be seen on the stage of the Racine Theater Guild under more normal circumstances. Tell us more about what this play looks like in that regard, in terms of trying to make it look like a not-so-great production.
Sure. The set is constructed similar to a something performance that would be made on a proscenium stage, which the Theater Guild is a thrust stage, so it comes right out into the audience. But you have this flat, it is an interior. It's supposed to be like an old British mansion, and there are actually hand-painted portraits, but they're painted on the walls, as are some of the chairs, as are the hooks that are non-existent. And throughout the play, we find that there are certain, as in reality, things malfunction. And at one point, the poorly constructed door falls apart, the handle falls off of it. At other points, you can see people actually putting their heads through what would be the glass window. And they're at one point, it's... For some of the actors, it's a little hard to tell what's painted on and what's real, so there is some confusion there about where to exit and where to enter.
A lot of gags.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, too, when you see right from the beginning, our Shakespearean-trained actor steps into a spotlight to say, to talk... Literally, it's just him. He breaks from whatever he's doing. He steps into a spotlight to talk about... the snow.
So what kind of a challenge is it, for instance, with all the things that are supposed to like break or malfunction and so on, to make that happen and to make that happen on cue versus, of course, in a real life situation where those things would just unfortunately happen as misfortunes in the moment? This has to happen when it needs to happen.
Yes. Well, it's always a challenge because when we go through rehearsals at the Theater Guild, we're downstairs in the green room, which it's all marked out approximately the space that we're going to use. And until we actually get out on stage, it's entirely different once we get out there. So once the actors have learned their blocking, which is where they're supposed to be, how they're supposed to move, then they have to kind of readjust it when they get out on the stage. Then when the set is entirely constructed, they have to learn, and with this one, it's not only how to perform in front of that space, but they actually have to be behind it, and and they're still on stage when they're behind it, so it's a trick. It's really a trick, and blocking the show, I have to say, and making sure the actors are where they're supposed to be at any given time, because it is a great deal in the timing. Was really tough. It was really tough because it's like you have to make sure that people aren't standing in a line. You have to make sure that everyone in the audience, and the Theater Guild is a wonderful place to see a show, but you have to make sure that you share with all those people that are all seated all around your stage. So it's a trick.
Yeah, no kidding. I bet this is a tremendous pleasure for the actors, in part because I think, as so often is the case, when there is a play that comes along that is about the world of theater, about the world of acting and directing and stagecraft and so on, that for those who kind of love to do that, where that's a part of their lives, it's kind of a delicious opportunity to enjoy that. Ed, what would you say about this experience as far as you're concerned, you and your fellow actors, in terms of this being an especially fun opportunity?
One thing I noticed about this show is that I read it early on, and I had a view of what it was going to be just in my head, and it's funny. There's a lot of gags. But watching the show evolve by way of these actors bringing their own take on the characters has been a real treat. For example, the character of Brent, I remember reading that at the time thinking, yeah, I think I could see myself in that part, you know, just kind of whatever. And now that Matthew has made that character his own, I can't imagine it being done any other way. I've never seen this show. I'd never heard of the show, but I've never seen the show live before. I have to imagine that it is a completely different show based on the actors who are playing these individual parts. Everybody has, and it's really neat to see for me as new to theater, watching everyone take their parts, lean into it, and make it their own. I can't imagine anyone else in any of these parts, and it sounds like I'm blowing smoke, but it's very true. The show, like I said, it was funny to read, but what the actors bring to it, present company excluded, are just elevates it to a level that I did not foresee coming. The people who are in this show, they know what they're doing, or maybe they've had good direction, but it is so fun to watch the evolution of these characters from the original read, the script read that we all had, and to now watching these people do what they do, bring their own elements to the characters, to enhance the characters, has been a lot of fun. Mm. I after this is done, I do want to see if I can watch someone else's production of it. It will be a completely different show, and I can't imagine a lot of the parts in this show, I can't imagine them being any better, because the actors have just spent so much time making the characters, bringing the characters to life. It has been a joy to watch.
Mm. And Sean, I suspect that that's not a coincidence. Did you come at this with that understanding that maybe even more so than is usually the case, that these actors needed to really become these characters in the way that made sense for them?
Absolutely. First of all, I was extremely lucky when we held auditions. There was a number of people that auditioned for this show. It was tough casting it, but I spent a great deal of time and what I feel is forethought in putting the right actor in the right spot. And like Ed says, they have done a phenomenal job. I am so happy to be able to watch them grow and create and become those characters, and they have done a phenomenal job. And they all get along really well, which is really nice.
Well,
very good.
The week is young.
So we have two more weekends of performances coming up, and can you share with listeners, if people want to attend, what they should do?
Absolutely. Call the Racine Theater Guild, make your reservations, you can get your tickets online, and do so in a hurry, because we're hoping that the crowds will sell out.
Wonderful. Well, as I said at the outset, I heard from several different people who attended one of the performances of the opening weekend that this play is just incredible. And it's not maybe all that often that a play comes to the stage that almost nobody has heard of. I mean, even you, Sean, had never heard of this play. It's one of those that just sort of floated under the radar, kind of an off-Broadway sort of show, but from all accounts, it's a fantastic play and very, very well done. And on the stage of the Racine Theater Guild for the next two weekends. So we urge people who are intrigued to seek out tickets for Drop Dead. Sean Britton, the director of this production, and the other director in Drop Dead, the onstage director, part of the cast, Ed Steckley.
I'm the fake director.
And a wonderful one, too, from the sounds of it. So I want to thank both of you for being part of the morning show today. And we wish you and your cast members all the best as you go forward with the next two weekends.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Greg. It was a pleasure.
Good to have you here. Part two of today's morning show coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. And part two of today's morning show comes from the Morning Show Archives. Well, once in a while you reach for a book on the shelf, not having any idea what the title really means. And this is such a book, actually, and I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to read it. It's called Never Eat Alone and Other Secrets to Success, One Relationship at a Time. The subtitle actually provides a pretty good clue, but then after that, sort of a second subtitle really clarifies it. The Ultimate Networker reveals how to build a lifelong community of colleagues, contacts, friends, and mentors. The author is Keith Ferrazzi, who is founder of his and CEO of his own marketing and consulting firm, Ferrazzi Greenlight. And he has contributed work in a number of things, including the Wall Street Journal, and has a long and very, very successful career in this industry. And he made a discovery very early on in terms of what successful people experience and the single factor which is probably most crucial to that success, and has found all kinds of intriguing ways and creative ways to make that a part of his own life as well. And that's what we're going to be talking about today on the morning show. Again, the book is called Never Eat Alone. It's published by Currency Doubleday. And Keith Ferrazzi, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, what a wonderful introduction. Thank you very much. You're very generous.
Well, no problem. I have really, really enjoyed this book. And I love the story with which the book begins, in which while you were, I think, working as a caddy at the country club in the town where you grew up, you sort of made an observation or a discovery about those people whose bags you were carrying. Tell us what that discovery was.
Sure. And first of all, at that time, I was actually very blessed to go to one of the more affluent and prestigious schools in the area, even though my dad was a steel worker and my mom was a cleaning lady. My dad had a real commitment to education. And I was sitting there caddying for the parents of some of my friends at school. And what I noticed was that this group of individuals, the wealthy elite in my town, really recognized one thing, and that is you can't get anywhere alone. And, you know, while they were out there on the golf course, they were getting their each other's kids' jobs. They were doing deals with each other. They were just constantly helping each other be successful. And I sat there, and I guess there's two ways you could look at that. One is I wasn't of that world. You know, I didn't have that special pass key to be on that golf course that was required, other than as a worker. On the other hand, what clicked into me was, you know what? I can create that. In a sense, the nepotism that I saw being practiced there, I could create very simply in my own life by actually generating real relationships with those individuals. That's all it was. I mean, they didn't care that each other was rich necessarily. What they cared was is that they knew each other and they had a relationship. And I started right there as a caddy. I mean, I actually started building the relationships with the people I was caddying with. And it was shocking how quickly those relationships, not only did they end up being great relationships, because that's primary. We're talking about sincere, real relationships here, not the schmoozing, insincere type that you think of when you think of the word networking. I have nothing to do with that. Sincere, real relationships, not only do they bring greater joy to your life, but they bring great rewards because other people will care about you and will show up to do amazing things for you if you do the same for them.
And you set up, in contrast, the picture of someone living in poverty as suffering from not just lack of financial resources, which is, of course, kind of the immediate situation or the immediate predicament, if you will, but the fact that so often the poor are suffering from an isolation that is so different from the generous network that you were just describing.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, we all get very comfortable hanging out with people that are exactly like us. And one of the things that I really recommend is that you bring in real diversity of relationships into your life. Now, and clearly, if what you want to achieve is break out of your social strata, my dad, more than anything else, wanted his son to be a huge success. My dad didn't have an education. My dad didn't have any money. I mean, what my dad wanted for me was to have me break out of that. And what I realized for myself is to break out of that social status. It doesn't mean that I don't still go home back to Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and hang out with my friends, you know, who work at the local gas stations. They're still great friends. But the point is, if I was to achieve the kind of things that I wanted to achieve, I needed to start hanging out with the professionals. I needed to start hanging out with the individuals who were in the milieu of the world that I wanted to be into. And that also, just any of your listeners who have jobs today, if you don't have a close personal relationship with your boss, I guarantee you raise is not going to be as big as it would be otherwise. You know, mentorship in big companies is all about the senior members of the firm who have access to power, reaching down and taking individuals that they see high potential in, but also care about and trust, and bringing them along. And you do not achieve that without real relationships.
I want you to briefly tell one other personal story, which also figures in this first chapter, and that is the relationship which you had with an important woman in your town, a woman by the name of Carol Poland.
Yep.
You were very good friends with her her son, Brett.
Exactly.
And but her openness to you, her generosity to you, was also a very, very important lesson for you.
Well, I mean, that's a good example. Here I was a caddy at the Latrobe Country Club. And again, you know, Brett and I were classmates, and they were incredibly wealthy. I mean, they had this beautiful home up in the hill, and we lived out in the country. But the kids, that didn't matter necessarily. But what I wanted to recognize was that Mrs. Poland was a fantastic woman. She was so lovely, so generous. You know, I sort of thought of her as a second surrogate mother to some extent, because I was over at the house enough. But when I caddied for her, because I cared about Mrs. Poland, you know, I did silly things. Like I hid her cigarettes from her because I really did care. I wanted to make sure that I actually came out to the golf course in advance in the morning, sometimes at 6 o'clock. I walked the golf course so I knew every tee placement there. Things that really made me want to make Miss, you know, what can I do? I didn't have anything that I could give Mrs. Poland, but what I did have, I gave. And what I didn't have, I created. And it was my sincere intimacy, my generosity, and my care for Mrs. Poland that I poured out to her. But I did that to so many of my clients, so to speak, on the golf course. And what happened in return? What I found, and again, I didn't do this because I was keeping score. I wasn't doing this because I wanted anything back. I did this because I really cared about Mrs. Poland, and the emotional gratification, the joy that I got back, was fantastic. What I found was that these individuals bend over backwards to think about me, to help me get ahead, to introduce me to people. I mean, Mrs. Poland was constantly bragging about me at the golf course. So all of a sudden, when other caddies, there was an abundance of caddies and very few people who ever wanted them, all of a sudden, for some reason, I constantly had clients. But even beyond that, these are the individuals who encouraged me to go get a degree at a great institution. I ultimately went to Yale. Some of them had connections at Yale that they were able to make good recommendations. These are individuals who helped me find, you know, higher order summer jobs beyond caddying. I mean, again, it was really an issue where they invested in me like I was of their own, but I was of their own. The point is that every one of your readers can be of the group that they achieve and aspire to be in, but they've got to focus on the real relationships.
Hmm. You characterize this as one of the softer skills which have helped you achieve the great success which you have, and I think that's kind of an interesting way to put it. I mean, it's these are skills that go beyond what seem like the most obvious necessities for succeeding in the business world.
Well, you know, in fact, it's just the opposite. The soft stuff is not only the most important stuff, but the soft stuff is probably, to some people, the hard stuff. In that, it's the emotional skills. It's the relationship skills. I've seen more people who are incredibly qualified in my career now, incredibly qualified individuals, who are still sitting in their cubicles at the age of 45 as 30-some-year-olds pass them by on the ladder of success in the company, and they sit there and they say, my gosh, that person just got that promotion because the boss liked them. Well, no kidding. You know, that's probably right. You know, all we really need in life is people to have faith in us and to give us a shot. After that, you know, the fact that you're 10% smarter than somebody else probably does not do much of a difference. I mean, as long as you hold your level, you hold your playing field, what really matters are the kind of people that you're hanging around and the kind of people that have made a commitment that they believe you're worthy of their attention and their time. So much of what we learn is from other people. And in large corporations, it's not the tactical, technical stuff that gets us ahead. It's the relationships and our capacity to, and particularly in sales and marketing, et cetera, those are all about the relationship. It's all about the soft stuff. Mm. And what we try to do in Never Eat Alone is give people those skill sets. And by the way, for your listeners, we also, I mean, I will be doing another book someday, but in the interim, we do a tip of the week at nevereatalone.com that people can go. Because, like, for instance, I'm terrible at names. I don't know about you. You probably are very good at it.
No, I'm with you.
Oh, I'm terrible remembering names. And so last week I read a really good book on names, and I went out and I wrote a tip of the week on that subject. So it's things like that that we try to keep people up on all the time.
Hmm. One of the things you mentioned very early in the book, and it's an important thing to consider, is that some of this flies in the face of prevailing wisdom or conventional thought, especially in the business world. And one of the things which you say has been true in America for a long time is our tendency to romanticize independence.
Right.
And
John
you're saying
Wayne, rugged individualism.
Right. And you're saying we really need to be able to step away from that, to let go of that.
Well, we really do. Particularly young people, again. I mean, I find so many young people who say, no, I'm going to do this myself. I'm not going to take help from other people. One of the things that I think a lot of people are missing is that there are so many people around you that want you to be a success, some of whom you don't even recognize now, and some of whom they don't even recognize it because you haven't done what you need to do to generate that intimacy between the two of you, the care. I mean, just think about each of you personally. How many of us have people around us that we really would love the opportunity? It would be a favor for me if I could help you, kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many people around us that we would really enjoy reaching out and helping. But why do we deprive those people of helping us? You know, is it a sense of ego? Is it a sense of pride? Is it a sense of insecurity that they're not going to be there? My dad used to say, you know, it never hurts to ask. The worst anybody could ever say is no.
Yes, so, you talk about your father and his, because he cared so much about you, he was willing to be audacious.
Yep.
in going to, I think, the head of the company, of this steel company where he worked, and to ask for help on behalf of you. And his courage, his willingness to step out and do that is something you've never forgotten.
Well, and not only do I never forget it, but I think about it all the time when I'm, you know, feeling a little bit cowardice myself. There's an entire chapter in the book about audacity. And, you know, there were times when my dad would pull off to the side of the road when we were going down the street and see a big wheel, you know, like a toy or something in somebody's garbage. And we were pretty poor, so, you know, he would know that either he stopped and he asked the owners of that house whether he could have it, or, you know, I might go without that. And my dad, you know, with great pride, would walk up the sidewalk and he'd knock on the door and he'd say, excuse me, I just noticed that you have this big wheel in your garbage. Do you think we could have that? You know, I, on the other hand, as a little 8-year-old, was hiding in the back seat of the car, you know, embarrassed. And what I remember now is every day I wake up and I ask myself, am I going to be that scared 8-year-old today? Or am I going to be that proud man like my father, you know, claiming the things in life that I deserve?
Hmm.
And that's always stuck with me.
You suggest that people need to create, among other things, what you call a personal board of advisors.
Yeah.
People that will be around them to help them and advise them and so on. And as we build this and other kinds of networks around us, at one point in the book, you make a list of all the people that are potential members of our own networks. And it's an astonishing list. I mean, we don't stop to think about the when we're talking about relatives and friends of relatives and current colleagues and neighbors.
When we teach people and we teach clients these things, you know, there's a 6-stage process to building the relationships for your company's success or relationships for your own life success. One of them is align. Align the assets and the resources and the people that you already have in your own backyard. If you just pulled out your resume today and you looked at all the places you've been, starting back at high school, I bet you could to write down three or four people who are really individuals that you could pick up the phone right now and call, some of whom you haven't talked to in 5, 10 years, but you could pick up the phone and call, and the relationship that you had with them once would still resonate in a way that they would reach out with great smiles and embrace you, you know, into their life today. But we lose track with all of these wonderful people that are, that could be very important to us today. So what we do is we just ask people to do two things. Number one, you know, think about the 20 people in the world today who are fundamentally going to be helpful and responsible for making you a success. Some of them are your bosses, some of them are your family members, for that, you know, for that matter. You've got to invest, you know, in time with your significant others, with your children, with your, you know, with yourself as well. So yourself should be, it's kind of, it sounds kind of corny, but yourself should be on that list of 20 people. You know, how are you investing in building a relationship there? But you know, of the other 15 or so, you probably know 10 of them today. Some of them maybe you are just acquaintances, but I guarantee you, if you really focus on how to make that person successful, if you really focus on how to reach out to those individuals, you can move somebody from I don't know you to an acquaintance to a friend within a year or two. And that's powerful. Not only will you have more joy in your life, you'll have more success.
You also work hard in this book to help us build the skills that make much of this possible. In, for instance, helping people understand what it means to strike up meaningful conversations where you're really going to be able to connect with them.
Yep.
You say that it's not about meaningless small talk. In fact, you talk about actually the importance of vulnerability.
I'm going to get to this in 1 second, but I just want to stop for a second and comment to your reader, to your listeners. Greg, you are really a special person. You have not only come to this discussion in this interview, you know, deeply prepared, but you've really thought about this stuff. And that's one of the most generous acts I could get as an author. So often I show up on radio shows, and I swear they've barely read the title. It's just really fantastic. And what you've invested in advance of this call is a real gift to your listeners as well. I just want to thank you for that.
Appreciate that.
But in terms of what you're just saying, we show up at cocktail parties, coffee hours, water cooler talk, etc., and we talk about the most mundane and unnecessary things that will never have an impact or will never be remembered. You show up at the water cooler next time or the next coffee hour or cocktail party at a conference or whatever, and you turn to somebody and you just ask them some simple questions like, hey, you know, What really lights you up? What are you really passionate about? I got to tell you something. If you start sharing a little bit about your kids, start sharing a little bit about that little league team that just really thrills you because you spend some time coaching because you care so much about children, whatever it is that really gets you excited, your dynamic and the conversation and the intimacy will intimately switch. Once you've really started sharing that kind of stuff, being willing, once you have a basic relationship already, you know, obviously don't reach out to somebody and start talking about fears and vulnerabilities right away. But once you have a basic relationship, you got to be willing to go to the level of talking about the things that you struggle with. Because otherwise, those are the kind of people that you think you know, but they seem to have this wall around them you can't just get deeper into. Those are the individuals who haven't let down their guard a little bit. Let down that wall and get to know people. And as I say to people, people are saying, gee, you know, well, if I do that, people will use that against me or I'll look weak. I'll tell you, there's probably only 5% of the population that are jerks like that. But don't live your life protecting yourself against the 5% of the world. Instead of showing up and being available and developing intimate relationships with the 95% of the world that will really empower you to your dreams.